Welcome to Gorgeous Reads on Radio Gorgeous, in association with the books page of Sainsbury's Magazine. For more information, go to sainsburysmagazine.co.uk, radiogorgeous.com.
My guest today is a Sunday Times bestselling author. She's won many awards, including the Somerset Maugham Award, the Costa Novel Award, and her last book was shortlisted for the Costa Award too. This is her seventh novel. She is Maggie O'Farrell, and the book we're talking about is This Must Be the Place. A gorgeous welcome, Maggie, to Radio Gorgeous.
Thank you very much.
So This Must Be the Place, I think, is about loyalty, forgiveness and acceptance. I found your book funny, surprising and moving. I found that comedy was one of the main sort of, can I say, stress busters in the book. It sort of kept it alive all the time.
Yeah, well, I think I wonder, when I started to write this book, I just had this urge to kind of rip up the rule book and really let myself go with it just to see where it would take me. And I wanted to write a book that reflected the sort of very multifaceted way we are. You know, I wanted to write a book about what it is to be human and to have made mistakes, but to try to rectify them. And I don't, you know, I think we're all very, very complex, nuanced beings, and the way we think and the way we perceive the world is not neat and ordered and chronological. And the book, I think, reflects that. It's not chronological, you know, it sort of jumps about in time and space, and you get one chapter from one person's point of view, then you get it from another point of view. And there are lots of stepchildren and adopted children and aborted children. And it's a very messy
life.
Well, I wanted it to reflect the way I feel about life and the way I feel we are, you know, the sort of braided chronology. I think we are very complicated beings. I think the way our memory works and our personalities are very, very layered. You know, we're very, maybe you might have an experience at the age of 5 which will disappear to the bottom of the pond until you're 25.
Yeah, because it's like, as I said, you feel everybody's itch, everybody's turmoil. The central character is Daniel. We hear from his perspective mostly. But we meet the people from his past, the present. We're inside their heads, their bodies. We feel their itches, pains and insecurities. We hear their present, past and even their future on a single page, which I really loved, you know, the way that you danced around in time. It's exactly what you said. And it just made it always a kind of a terribly curious read, you know.
Yeah, well, that's good to know. I mean, I think that one of the characters, Daniel's first son, has really chronic eczema. And I think he's a sort of literal representation of the theme of the book, because everybody in the book is at some point uncomfortable in their skin. They find their situation unlivable. And Niall, the boy with the eczema, sort of represents that in a way.
I couldn't believe how bad it was. And at the end of the book, you say thanks to a hospital for all your advice. Can you explain how bad it was to people?
Well, it's not me who has it. My middle daughter was born with chronic eczema as a baby.
As bad as Niall's?
Yeah, as bad, probably a bit worse actually at times. And it is, I mean, I think the misleading thing about eczema is that most people think of it as a small symptom. They think of a small dry patch of skin somewhere. But for some people, some very unfortunate people like Niall and my daughter, it is a disease. It's head to foot. It's constant. It's 24 hours a day. It's something that makes your life just unlivable. You know, it's impossible. You know, there are days when my daughter would walk across the floor and the skin of her ankle would split and tear, and her knee, you know, it's actually difficult to wear clothes. I mean, this is at its worst, but it's even when it's, you know, manageable, it's a constant background hum for families that live with that.
So I'm interested to know how old she is and how she's managing now.
She's 7 now, and she is a bit better, because actually I have devised a whole separate regimen for her. When she got to the age of about 5, she'd been so bad. I mean, she'd actually been hospitalised. She'd been in A&E because she had skin infection. She'd gone in through to, she'd got septicemia. Her legs had ulcerated. I mean, it was, I had literally never seen anything like it. And there was one day when her hand swelled up with a staphylococcus infection, and I took her to the doctor, and she wore gloves all the time, and I pulled it off, and the doctor just gasped, and she said, take her to A&E right now. So, you know, I think it's been the most challenging thing as a parent to cope with. Obviously, not as challenging as it is for her. You know, she's the one who has to live inside that. So about that point, I just thought, there has to be another way, because the received sort of mainstream medical approach to eczema is there is no cure. You just have to manage it, which is frustrating, because you think, you know, you can cure so many things. Why can't you cure this? But I think eczema is a very complicated, it's a very individual condition, and everybody's just different and has different causes. So we tried endless amounts of things. I was just so determined to try to make her life better, you know, because as a parent, as a mother, all you want for your child is to be able to live their life, to be out there in the world, engaging with it. But how do you do that if the world makes your child sick? You know, if she can't make a sandcastle or dig in the soil or swim in a sea or swim in a pool. You know, all these things were impossible for her, sitting on an upholstered chair.
Even impossible to sit in an upholstered chair?
Yeah, she couldn't sit on an upholstered chair because it's too itchy. I mean, leather chairs like this one we're sitting in now, that would have been okay, but anything else would have been... She couldn't sleep in a bed, anything other than her own, which didn't have allergy sheets and special bedding. And yeah, it's a horrible, debilitating condition, and I have utmost pity for anyone who has to put up with it. So I did a lot of research, and I've managed to devise a kind of regimen for her which works. It's manageable. You know, she's so much better. She doesn't constantly get infections. She doesn't have to be wrapped as much as she should. She can have swimming lessons, which she's over the moon about.
So tell me what it is that you're doing.
Well, basically, we've banished every single detergent from the house. I read a very persuasive article about how atopic illnesses like asthma and eczema skyrocketed after detergents were introduced into houses in just after the war, 1947. So we banished everything, and even we had lots of cleaning products then, which were ostensibly green and natural, but actually when you read the very, very fine print, they're full of things called surfactants and even plant-based detergents. And this dermatologist said that this was still would cause it, so we got rid of every single thing, and I now clean the house.
And vinegar and lemons, then,
that
and
kind of
soda
thing.
Water,
yeah, so it's
soda.
Mainly a lot of Castile soap, a lot of olive oil soap, natural soap in the laundry. So there's nothing in the house, and I also use a lot of aloe vera on my daughter, but it has to be 99% pure, which is difficult to find because most stuff in shops is cut with glycerin and other stuff. And I also make my own cream, which is something I never imagined I would be doing.
What, for your own skin as well?
No, well, for my daughter mostly. Yeah, I make a cream for her. I do make other creams as well.
So tell me the recipe.
Well, it's lots of things in it. It's got shea butter in it. It's got a bit of aloe vera. It's got rose hip. It's got hemp oil. It's got safflower. A bit of lemon. It smells. It's lots of beeswax, actually. Beeswax is a very important ingredient because it creates a barrier, a waterproof barrier. And amazingly, it is, touch wood, and at the moment, working for her. She's certainly improved an awful lot.
It's brilliant. So you have become a kind of white witch, haven't you, really?
I suppose a little bit. I do a lot of stirring and things. But I think, you know, if your child is sick and suffering, there's nothing you wouldn't do.
You're as unhappy as your most unhappy child. So you felt
exactly.
Her every pain, didn't
well,
you?
It is, you know, I mean, she was, on a bad night, she'd be awake 9 times, 10 times a night. On a good night, she'd be awake 2, 3 times, you know, and it was... You know, she was exhausted, I was exhausted. She was at the end of her tether. You know, she said to me one day, I'm going to get very emotional talking about this, she said, you know, I can't take this anymore. And she was 5. You know, and I thought...
Say something so intelligent. Yeah.
It was so intelligent, but absolutely devastating to hear. You know, nobody wants to hear their 5-year-old say that.
Yeah.
So I just thought, I have to do something. I've got to try everything you can. Because, you know, when you have a child, you make a pact. It's a pact in a way that you're going to look after them come what may. And so you have to, no one else is going to do it for
Unconditional,
you.
Unconditional, yeah.
You've got to do it yourself.
RadioGorgeous.com.
So I'm interested to know, has the changing all these things in your house benefited anybody else? I mean, apart from your sleeping, I mean, as in, is their skin better? Does the house smell different? You know, what's...
Yeah, I think the house is different. I mean, my asthma is certainly a lot better. I don't know whether that's that or whether it's something else.
My youngest daughter,
she has a tiny bit of eczema on the backs of her, you know, she has it on the backs of her knees and the crooks of her elbows. I've no idea that if maybe the house had been different, she would have got a lot worse. I don't know. It certainly feels better. I mean, once you know what's in these products, you don't want them anywhere near your children ever again.
God, thank God I hate cleaning. So I just need to know about your colouring, because I often find people who have these things. I had a friend and her son had red hair and pale green eyes. If cheese touched his body, he went up in hives. I'm just wondering, you're very pale, you're obviously Celt, with reddish hair and very blue eyes.
Yeah.
What's the colouring of your daughter?
My daughter's very, very fair. She's got white, white blonde hair and very, 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 very pale skin. I don't know. I mean, to be honest, I've spent a lot of time in dermatology clinics, and I think children of every hair colour, every race, it doesn't seem to differentiate.
But you've had asthma, though. Has your partner had anything
like that? My husband has very mild asthma. Oh, sorry, eczema. But he's very olive-skinned. You know, he's Jewish. He's got dark hair. He's got olive skin, so... Who knows? We don't know why it happened or why it happened to her. It's just, I think there's no whys in this situation. It's just, what can we do about this?
Well, it's writing about it, was that, do you feel like you're reaching out to other people?
I think if you're living through something which is so visceral like this, it's going to appear in your writing in some way. And I think also, often if people in literature or fiction appear and they have eczema or an allergy or something, they're often, it's often a kind of comedic device, you know, and they're often depicted as a weakling or as a bit kind of pathetic. And that always enrages me, because these kids who have these things, they are anything but. They are the essence of stoicism and bravery and tolerance. And so I wanted to write a character who has really bad eczema, but he's nothing like that. He's incredibly brave. He's actually the emotional centre of the book.
Oh, that's a lovely thing to say. Well, yeah, because in the end, well, I'm not going to go into what he does.
We don't want to give it away.
We don't want to give anything away. I just want to talk about Daniel's wife, Claudette, who's obsessed with privacy. She's become an international film star by accident. But really, she should be a builder or a gardener. I mean, I really think she's only happy in her overalls. She's passionate, psychic, caring, and a loyal daughter. Is she any part of you?
Any part of me? God, no. No, I wouldn't write myself as a very famously beautiful star.
Yeah, but trying to run away.
Possibly. I mean, actually, the idea for Claudette came when I... In fact, my middle daughter was a tiny baby, and I was in Soho with her, and she was in a sling. And I was in that very sort of exhausted, sort of slightly detached state when you've just got a very new baby. And I went to a cafe for a cup of tea, and I sat down, and I suddenly thought, there's a really odd atmosphere in this room, but I couldn't quite work out why. And then I realised that sitting opposite me, almost as close as you are to me now, was an incredibly famous actress. I mean, so famous that she'd have been known anywhere in the world. And she looked absolutely miserable. I mean, she was sitting there with her head in her hands, and if she hadn't been who she was, I would have said to her, are you okay? You know, is there something I can do to help you? And at one point, I ended up walking behind her to the ladies' loo in her sort of slipstream in a way. And it was only then that I could get a kind of sense of what it was like to be her, to live inside her life, because everybody in the cafe was turning around and pointing her out to their friends, taking photographs of her on their phone. There were loads of paparazzi outside the cafe. She was heavily pregnant at the time. Taking photos of her, and when I reached the loo, she was already in there. She was already in the ladies, and she had her head pressed against the mirror with her eyes closed, just sort of taking a moment on her own. And I just thought, God, what a terrible life! How horrific it must be to not have your anonymity, to be constantly watched and constantly hounded. And yeah, I couldn't. It was horrifying. And as I walked away, I had to actually fight my way through the photographers who were outside waiting for her. And I thought, God, if I was her, I would walk away.
Well, I wouldn't be in Soho.
And I don't know. Who knows? Maybe she had a meeting. I have no idea. But I thought it's an untenable life. I couldn't live like that. And as I walked away, I thought the kind of character, the idea of a Claudette, sort of first appeared in my mind.
Radio Gorgeous. Gorgeous lives. How do your books come together? Because you're on your seventh book now. You must be getting quite good at it.
I don't know about that. Well, every book feels really different, actually. I think every book is like every child, in a way.
Yeah.
You know, every single one of them has their particular joys and their particular challenges. And just because you've written one book doesn't mean you can write another, you know, I think.
Every time
it's
like...
With every one, it's completely different. And you have to learn it from scratch, in a way.
Oh, I love that. I love that. So... I must say, the Esme Lennox one, is that quite a famous one? Because I think I've heard of that one.
I don't know. Some people say they like that one. Yeah, that was one I wrote when my son was really young. Yeah.
So you wrote a book when your son was really young?
Yeah, well, I've got three kids, actually. My youngest child is almost four, and I've been writing this book ever since she was tiny. Yeah, I wrote the first opening chapters, and she was asleep on my chest.
So it's taken about 3 or 4 years?
Yeah, then. it took about that long.
Yeah, I bet, especially when you've got small children.
Yeah.
That's one of the main problems. So I want to ask about being Irish, because when I met you, I said, hang on, you've got an English accent.
Yeah, I know.
This is wrong. You look Irish, you've got an Irish name, you write about Ireland, you know. Do you feel Irish? And are your parents a base?
Well, it's a tricky question to answer, actually, which I've never been able to answer with a simple word. I mean, I was born in Northern Ireland and I lived there but I moved to Wales when I was a toddler. So we used to go back every year to Ireland in the summer. So we used to go to the west of Ireland, to Donegal, where this book starts, and Connemara and Galway. So I never really got the accent, which is a shame, actually. But I don't really know what I feel, actually. I feel a bit confused in a way, because I spent 10 years in Wales and then I moved to Scotland. And then after that, I moved to Hong Kong, and then I came to, and I lived longest in London. That's the place where I've lived in my whole life the longest time. And actually, I live in Edinburgh mostly these days. So I don't know, a bit confused is the answer, really, is what I feel.
Okay, so you feel, again, like most people.
Yeah, exactly.
And you met your partner at Cambridge, is that right?
Yeah, we met as students. We weren't actually together then. We didn't get together for quite a long time later, when I was about, I think, 27 or something, 28. But yeah, we were friends for quite a long time.
He's a writer as well. Mm. Are you competitive, or are you supportive, or are you both?
I think you couldn't be competitive with the person you're married to, actually. So no, there isn't. I mean, both, we actually write very, very different things, but no, I think we're highly supportive. I think you couldn't be. I think your marriage would be over if you were competitive, you want the other person to do badly, wouldn't you? Yeah. And that wouldn't, you couldn't,
well, no,
you couldn't
just want
have
to do
a relationship
better than them, you know.
Yeah, I don't think you could have a relationship. So no, not at all. Mm. And I think we're very, even before we were a couple, actually, we were very supportive of each other's writing. And he's always been one of my first readers.
So he started off as a friend. Yeah, I keep meeting people that have these really good marriages because they started off as friends.
Oh, really? That's interesting. Yeah, well, it's funny because I think we know it's, even when we got together, we knew each other so well, and we knew all our exes very well. We were kind of friends. And so, yeah, I suppose it's a different starting point to most relationships. But, I mean, I think it's the same as any couple who are in the same line of work. There's a lot less to explain, in a way.
Yeah.
You know, if I go into his study, I wander in, and he suddenly says, don't come in. I wouldn't, or, you know, I'm busy. I wouldn't take it the wrong way. I just know he's concentrating and I'll talk to him later. So, and I think also, you know, he reads everything I write. He's always the first person to, so he'll read probably an early draft. He'll read maybe the third or second or third draft. And, you know, he's very honest with what he thinks. And there are some times when he says things that, you know, are very difficult to hear. When I wrote Esme Lennox, he read an early draft and he said, it's not bad, but you need to rewrite half of it. And that was, so we had a couple of, slightly difficult days maybe after that. But actually, he was right. You know, I think you need someone to read your books. You don't want somebody just to say, yes, it's lovely, because you need someone who cares about you enough to say, this bit works, but that bit doesn't. And this bit, I can't tell what you're talking about. And that metaphor's too, you know, flowery. So it's very useful.
Now, I must talk about words, because words are... I mean, I kept having to ask my husband, because he went to Cambridge and did Greek and Latin, did the classics. Yeah. So he's really good on words. I had to ask him probably about 7 words in this book. I didn't know what they meant. I should have.
You can tell me later.
But I'm just wondering, I mean, are you, like the central character, obsessed by words? It felt like you are, in a good way.
I think I am, actually. I mean, I think, actually, writing about a linguistics professor was quite a nice outlet for my very geeky obsession with words. I mean, actually, when I went to university,
Did you do English?
Yeah, I did English literature, and you also had to do a paper in a foreign language, and I'm really shocking at foreign languages. I always have been. I'm not very good. I've just managed to get through my higher German. But so the other option I could have done was this thing called History of the English Language, and I didn't really know what it was, and I kind of thought, well, I'm going to have to do it. So I kind of went along to the lecture slightly underwhelmed, and I was utterly transfixed. I loved it, and it's one of the parts of my degree that really, really has stayed with me. And it was all about the history of the language and why it is the way it is and why we say the words we use and how words have changed. And so I did do a sort of linguistics module at university as part of my degree, which, and that's where all Daniel's obsession comes from.
So is linguistics, is it about the history, the roots, how we use it? Is it kind of...
Well, it's a huge discipline and it covers all those things. Yeah, it covers the history of the language, so where words come from, their Latin and Greek origins or Anglo-Saxon origins or whatever. And it also explains why words are the way they are and why we speak the way we do. You know, there's certain influences, whether it's pop songs or culture or American culture or, a character on TV or anything. All these things influence the way we talk and the way, say, a teenager will talk in a different way with their friends than they would with their parents. It's all about register. You know, you change the way you speak to people you know and people you don't know, and depending on what situation you're in. And that's what linguists are interested in.
And how can they use it as a career?
Well, he's a lecturer. You know, he gives lectures in language change. He gives lectures in the origin of languages. At the beginning of the book, he's about to go and deliver a lecture on creoles, which is a kind of... a sort of hybrid language.
Creole, yeah.
Yeah, pigeons and creoles. Yeah. He's about to go and do that. So, yeah, he talks to students. That's how he makes
his
living.
That's how he uses it, yeah. I love the way you have this room just full of words everywhere. Yeah.
Darling, I only listen to Radio Gorgeous. Uh-huh.
But yeah, you've taught creative writing. Mm. Again, did that help, hinder, enhance you?
I don't know if it certainly was a different thing. I used to do it... before I had my son, actually, so quite a long time ago. He's almost 13 now. And I did it at Warwick and then at Goldsmiths for a while. And it was very, it was a, you know, I really liked, I think one of the things I found becoming, when I gave up my job as a journalist, I found being at home quite difficult on my own. I didn't really like it. I really missed the sort of social aspect of an office. And so, yeah, it was really, it's good to get you out of the house, I think, to go to it. And also you meet, you know, other people, especially young people, and get to hear their ideas. So I really enjoyed it, actually.
And their words.
Exactly, and their words. So it's always good to be out there in the world.
So you've got three small children. You're obviously finding the discipline to write. I just want to know what other things you're interested in as well.
Other things? Well, there's not a huge amount of space for much else at the moment, actually. It's quite time-absorbing. What else do I do? I love being out and about. I do quite a lot of exercise. I do a lot of yoga. I grow succulents in my greenhouse.
Wow! I suppose yeah. They have to be in the greenhouse in Edinburgh, don't they? They can't be outside.
Oh, yeah, no, they couldn't survive outside. So I have them along the kitchen windowsill and I have them in the garden. Because I grow a lot of aloe vera, actually, to help my daughter's
of
skin.
Of course, and, it works.
Yeah, it works, yeah.
You can just break it off, snap it off,
and it's the gel inside. So if you ever burn yourself or you have a skin problem or it's itchy or an insect bite, you just slap it on and it will be lots
you've
better.
You've got a greenhouse. I'm so envious.
It's very dilapidated. Don't be envious. It's probably a terrible health and safety hazard.
And I just must ask, I mean, I love Edinburgh. I mean, it's culture, the Georgian buildings, you know, it's near the sea. Why are you there, both, all of you?
Well, I really love London. I really miss London an awful lot. And in many ways, it feels like home. But I wanted a place where... I mean, actually, one of the big reasons we're there is because of the education system. You know, I'm terrified of what the government is doing to young kids in schools these days. You know, these exams, this obsession with grammar. You know, I really feel that their imaginations are being boxed off and strangulated. And one of the reasons we moved to Scotland is because they start school a year later there. So you start school at 5 rather than 4. I mean, actually, it ended up my kids go to a progressive school where you don't start formal education until they're 6 and there are absolutely no exams. I went very hardcore because I really thought, I don't want to put my kids through this.
Is it Stein School?
Yeah, they go to Stein School.
Wow, and there is one up there.
Yeah, it's a fantastic school. They absolutely love it and we love it. And it means that they are completely out of the loop of this whole new pressure that's being applied to children and this whole very, very formal, very po-faced education. So it's something I'm really passionate about, you know, the way that we must let our children be children. We must let them have a childhood. We should not be putting them in exam halls. We should not be teaching them grammar. We're strangling the joy out of reading and writing and creativity.
And have you seen, I mean, I suppose it's hard to compare your children to other children, but yeah. What have you seen, you know, how are your children?
My children are great. I mean, they love it. They spend a lot of time outdoors. They spend a lot of time, you know, digging in the soil and making dens and... That's the dream childhood, and that's what I want for them, and I'm very lucky to be able to give it to them.
Now, obviously, this must be the place. It is mentioned that the actual title in the book. Where did that come from?
Well, I think the title comes from the sense that it sounds like a confident assertion, but actually, it isn't. You know, there isn't. The point is, there isn't really a place. Wherever you go, you take yourself to. You're still in your skin, so you can change location, you can change geography, you can change your life, you can change your partner. But you're still who you are. You're still inside your own skin.
Maggie O'Farrell, thank you so much for coming on to Radio Gorgeous. And it's available. It's published by Tinder Press.
This must be
the place. Thank you so much.
It was absolutely my pleasure. Thank you.
Radio Gorgeous, pirate radio for Vogue readers.
Thank you.
radiogorgeous.com.